The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Thaddeus Russell is a historian, author, and professor. He has taught history, American studies, and the history of philosophy at Columbia University, Barnard College, and the New School for Social Research. He is also the host of the Unregistered podcast and the guest on this week's podcast. While we start off discussing the anti-social justice warrior industry and Russell's own encounters with it, we quickly veer off into a conversation about capitalism, Foucault, whether rationalism is necessarily imperialistic, Sam Harris, Noam Chomsky, and a variety of other topics. It's late on Wednesday, March 7th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. I want to thank James T., Jason R., Andrew F., Matt S., and R. for becoming patrons in the last few days. They, along with 200 other patrons of the Inside Zero Books podcast, are making the expansion of Zero Books digital content production possible. And I also want to remind listeners that if you enjoy this podcast, especially if you enjoyed this conversation or end up enjoying this conversation with Thaddeus, you might want to become a patron of Inside Zero Books as well, as the second half of this conversation is coming out for members only this weekend. If you haven't already, you might pick up a copy of Marx Returns by Jason Barker, or get a hold of Angela Nagle's Kill All Normies, which was recently selected as one of the top 10 books of 2017 by the novelist George Saunders. Or, if you've had enough of Nagle and want to re-embrace the call-out culture, you can get yourself a copy of Sean Scott's Millennials and the Moments That Made Us, which was published by Zero Books in February. The music you're listening to right now is Theodore Adorno's 1921 String Quartet. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Thaddeus Russell and I debate rationality and humanism. Thaddeus Russell has taught at Columbia University, Barnard College, Eugene Lane College, the New School for Social Research, and Occidental College. He is the author of A Renegade History of the United States and the voice behind the Unregistered podcast, which I was recently on. So this is payback. Thaddeus Russell, thank you for coming on to the Zero Squared podcast. I guess today we're going to talk about the anti-social justice warrior industry. And maybe I should start by talking about Joe Rogan, because you've been a recurring guest on that podcast.
Yeah, I've been on three times.
Right. And would you say that is the center of the biggest star in that galaxy?
Yeah, I think of Rogan more as a hub of it. He's, you know, he is, of course, interested in many things, but he has, for reasons that are somewhat unknown to me, but I can speculate on them, he has gravitated increasingly toward these guys who you call members of the anti-SJW industry, and I think that's somewhat apt. It's also been called the intellectual dark web by a guy named Eric Weinstein, who's a part of it. So this includes people like Sam Harris, Jordan Peterson, Brett Weinstein, or is it Steen? No, Weinstein, and his brother Eric Weinstein, who's actually quite interesting. We should talk about him. But and then, you know, those are the big stars, and then there's some sort of secondary, less prominent, but still prominent people. This guy named Gad Saad, who's this, Yeah, he's pretty remarkable. and then who else is there? I mean, so then there's sort of bigger luminaries. So I don't know if they've been on Rogan, but they certainly have the sort of mentors of these guys. So Dawkins, Richard Dawkins, of course. I feel like I'm missing someone. But it's interesting because I was on his show the first time, I think in 2015 or 14. And he, you know, it's still unclear to me why he brought me on, except just that a lot of people sort of had suggested to him, I think, that I'd be on the show. He didn't know anything about me. He simply knew that I was a professor at Occidental College. And that was when the sexual assault, whatever you want to call it, hysteria, panic, concern, was really centered at Occidental, kind of began there, in fact, as a national movement. This was in right around 2014. And so I talked about that on the show with Rogan. And that's, I think, what made my appearance especially popular and made me very popular among his audience. And that's when I first sort of learned about what was going on out there, that there's this very large subculture. And it really is a subculture. It's not something that's talked about or even known about really in sort of what we might call the normie or establishment media. So, you know, I've told Rogan like that if you look at the list of the top 200 podcasts, it's a really clear distinction. There's a really clear sort of separation between essentially sort of the NPR type podcasts. I mean, they're actual NPR podcasts and they're sort of NPR affiliates do podcasts. And those make up probably a third of all of the top 200 podcasts. And then there's these people, the sort of intellectual dark web. Harris is a big podcast, Rogan, et cetera. And they don't, I get the sense that the audiences are almost totally unaware of each other, that the producers of those podcasts are unaware of each other. I mean, I know lots of people, and I'm sure you do, who are NPR types. They listen to NPR, sort of what I call sort of liberal establishment people. When I talk to them, they have never heard of Rogan. They've never heard of Joe Rogan, who is arguably the biggest star in all of alternative media. If you take YouTube, all of YouTube and all of podcasts together, I mean, I would say it's arguable that he's the biggest star in that whole universe, which is, of course, quickly becoming, or maybe already has become, the dominant form in media now. So, but anyway, I found out that there's this large subculture of people who are his audience and the audience of a lot of these people, and mine as well, who seem to be mostly men, mostly young men, in their 20s and 30s, mostly white. I think of them as sort of working class intellectuals, actually, and not really in the way that Gramsci talks about working class intellectuals. But these are people who a Marxist, I think, would call working class. I think someone like me would call working class, in that they are culturally, their cultural structure is akin to what we associate with American black and working class actually culture and European working class culture. They are non-bourgeois in the way that they think about the world, in the way they think about gender and sex and freedom and pleasure and work and discipline and family. These tend to be, in my experience, young men who are alienated actually from much of bourgeois culture. They're not usually family men. They're not usually very interested in being a good husband or a good father. They are very interested in, they are hostile to attempts to repress their sexuality. That's a major thing for them, especially for Rogan, and to repress their identity, which tends to be masculine. So masculinism, I think, is central to it. And that's the one thing that I tend to dislike. I don't think it's wrong or bad or evil. It's not my bag, but it is also very much emblematic, I think, of, you know, what we think of as sort of American working class culture, right? Where men are men and women are women.
Sure. I have a knee-jerk Marxist response to any of these descriptions of the working class as having a culture, just because I feel like we spend so much time talking about class as if it's cultural. And, you know, from this strict Marxist perspective, it's all about the relationship that a person has to the means of production, whether or not you work for a wage. That's what defines your class, not whether you wear a baseball cap or a fedora or, you know, have a perfectly moosed hair or use a hair dryer or whatever. But I do think I know what you're talking about despite that. So I just wanted to put that little caveat on the term working class. Why is it, do you think? Because I don't know if I think it really has to do with class dynamics exclusively, but the gender dynamics in the country seem important. And maybe also whether or not you're urban or rural, or whether you're college educated or not, or whether or not you have an advanced degree or not.
Right.
Do you work in an office or do you work in some sort of job that's more physical, in a factory maybe, or maybe as a trucker? Is that the divide, rural and urban, educated? No,
the divide that I see, and I've talked about this actually publicly, is to me it's really – there's sort of a cultural civil war going on, and between those who I – say are of college and those who are not of college. And when I mean of college, I mean those people who have been acculturated into the mores of essentially the elite universities in this country, right? So there's a particular language, a particular way of speaking, a particular said there's an etiquette, right, in all those schools that are taught. It's not just chemistry and Shakespeare and philosophy that they teach. They teach a way of being, which is, you know, I think a Marxist would recognize as the training that is necessary for the ruling class, right? It's real. I do, and I think I completely.
So it might be the difference between
subscribe
like,
to that. Yeah,
you went to a state school, or you went to an Ivy League school, or an upper tier school. Because if you went to like a regular state university and got a degree in business so that you could get a good job, you're not going to be of college the way you're talking about.
Yeah. So you can go to Harvard and still not be of college. You can refuse to be acculturated. Right. And I've many of my listeners and people who have taken my courses at Renegade University and stuff, that's who they are. I mean, they've been to the elite schools. They just hated it and they didn't want to be a part of it and they rejected it. And that's when, so they felt there's an alienation that's really common among these people, I have found. You know, again, back to this thing about culture and class, or, I think that it is very important. One's economic position, whether one is a member of the owning class or a member of the working class, I still basically use those Marxist definitions. You know, if you need to work in order to survive, your working class, that's sort of how I think of it. I think that's very important. Obviously, that shapes your life. It's essential in your life. But I think class as a cultural category is just as important. So the way that people think about what they should do and what class they do belong to, even if they are wrong in strict economic terms, also determines who they are and how they live, and how they behave, how they operate, how they vote, how they do all sorts of things. So it's really – and those things can be totally independent, as we know that polls of Americans always have shown that the vast majority of Americans consider themselves to be middle class. That Americans don't like to use the term working class. That if you ask a cashier at CVS, they will more than likely describe themselves not as working class. They'll describe themselves as middle class. And more importantly, you'll see in much of what Marxists would call the working class in this country, at least, a really strict adherence to what Marxists would call bourgeois norms. They believe that the nuclear family is good, that work is good in itself, that, right, that one should be civil and respectful and obey authority and be a patriotic and all that. And that's very important. I mean, that really determines how those people live. And so it's,
And on the nuclear family bit, I'm in a nuclear family. I'm a father of four kids. I'm still married to the same woman after 23 years. We're the typical nuclear family. I mean, she's going to work now, but now that our kids are older, I feel as though the left misses the boat on critiquing the family. Not because that we shouldn't critique it, but that the way we go about it is all backwards. It's like the fact that the nuclear family is a threat is not symptomatic of some, not overall, it's not symptomatic of some great liberating force in society. It's the fact that, you know, things are more precarious than ever is what I think. And, you know, not that we shouldn't have other kinds of relationships or, you know, critique the nuclear family as the baseline or some sort of absolute norm, but it is a functional unit. You know, it works. It does things that people need, like, for instance, provide support for child rearing and, you know, direction for children. And that's all important. And if you take that away, and dump these kids into state institutions, whether it's, you know, long hours at school or daycare centers, you are losing something in the process, and we shouldn't pretend like you're not.
Well, let's take all these things together that we're talking about. So we have these elite universities, you know, we could just the shorthand here, we could say it's the top 200 in the U.S. News and World Report rankings. You know, that's pretty good, I think, index of what's elite and where this culture that I'm talking about is produced and perpetuated, right? There's those things, those elite universities, the sort of higher education system generally. Okay. The nuclear family, it's another one. I would say, the sexual repression, generally speaking, the way that Freud speaks about it, which is basically silence. I call it the great bourgeois silence, that we simply don't speak about sex. Right. The good people, good Americans don't speak about sex. And so it's not spoken about in families. It's not spoken about in schools. You're not supposed to speak about it in public, and public officials certainly shouldn't speak about it. Right. So that's that collection of things, norms, cultural forms were made dominant, right, by what Marxists call the bourgeoisie in the 18th and 19th centuries. And so since then, right, people in the West, and especially in the United States, have just assumed that those are all good. Those are all good. And one should go to a college that is like one of those colleges. One should be in a nuclear family, husband and wife and children. One should not speak about sex in public or even in private quite often. One should be restrained in the way that they behave. One should not be ostentatious. One should be modest and humble. Those are all, right, classic bourgeois norms, and those became dominant, you know, well, not that long ago. So in this country, really in the 19th century. And so that stuff is crucial, right? That's important. And they're also new, and they're weird. They're weird historically, right? If you look at the whole sweep of human history, it's been just a second, basically, 1 second in human history when those norms have been dominant and widely assumed. And then geographically, of course, even today, much of the world doesn't subscribe to those norms. Those are sort of alien ideas to much of the world today. And so there clearly have been and still are alternatives to them. There's nothing sort of inscribed in nature about them. They're not our destiny. They're not something that God gave to us and demands of us.
What was the family structure like before historically? Wasn't it more the extended family that was important, and it was a more agricultural community?
Yeah. So the extended family has been the norm in most of the world, including in this country, until fairly recently. And now it's sort of coming back, by the way. But that's one of the major criticisms of immigrants. That's what it's always been since the 19th century, since the first big wave of immigrants, was that they don't come here just mom and dad and the kids. They come here with aunts and uncles and cousins and grandma and grandpa and all these people, and they live in the same tenement a building in the Lower East Side or the same barrio in Southern California. And all these people congregate together, they live together, they live near each other, they raise the kids together. And that's not good, because we don't do that. We do the nuclear family here, because the nuclear family teaches discipline and responsibility and and respect for authority. There's a clear hierarchy in a nuclear family.
See, I take a different perspective. I don't think that the, I mean, maybe you probably know better than I, but I don't think that the extended family was less repressive than the nuclear family. It's just repressive in different ways. And
sure.
And that, I don't think that the reason people primarily object to immigrants bringing their entire extended family over is because they don't like the cultural form. The problem is that it costs money. There are all these people who are looking for work, and so they're either competing. More and more people are competing in the job market, or they're taking money from the state. So that's the objection.
So I can just tell you historically, the reason that was offered for the state supporting the nuclear family, which it did in various ways, beginning in the 19th century, was that it creates disciplined individuals, the self-regulating individual who's at the center of classical liberalism, right? American freedom is really self-regulation. It's really repression. And the courts, the Supreme Court and other and sort of major public intellectuals and some statesmen in the 19th century said this explicitly. You can read Nancy Cott, her work. She's a Yale historian. She's written extensively on this, quite good. And so that's why I don't like it. Because just the structure of it, right? The thing that I don't like about it primarily, and it's really this simple, it requires a tremendous amount of work because all of the responsibility for raising these children is on you and your wife, and that's it. The nuclear family is supposed to be on an island because in this country, you're not supposed to be dependent on others, and especially you're not supposed to be dependent on the state. So to be a parent in a nuclear family is to live a life of work because you have to make the money to support the family and you got to raise the family, just the two of you, if you're going to be a good American citizen, good American parents, good American mother. And so that's what it's about. The Puritan work ethic, in a sense, is also within it, right? It's kind of inscribed in it as well. That's exactly why I reject it. So the extended family, if you talk to people who were raised in extended families, they'll talk about how there was just far less work for everyone because it was spread around. It was much more collective, actually. So I would think that socialists would be sympathetic to it. Well, actually,
I'm totally sympathetic to extended families, but I don't think that the extended family in an agricultural setting is necessarily where we should go next. Not that I'm against that idea. I'm not sure it's. I don't want to make a utopia out of the extended family because it comes up in a particular time where life was more rugged and the kind of work that needed to be done was more extensive and the kind of discipline that was needed was more – I think there was more – it was more fierce in some ways and not as fierce in others. The thing that really is important to underline is that the need for an urban proletariat is what was behind the state's – function support for the nuclear family. And atomization of families is helpful for the production of a proletariat. Am I wrong?
Well, I know that's Engels' theory. I would say if so, only indirectly. So what we have is lots, as I said, lots and lots of documentation of what people, jurists and policymakers, were actually saying about the nuclear family, you know, in the 19th century when it was first supported by the state. And that's what they were saying. They were talking about making people into good, orderly citizens.
Yeah, but why did they want good, orderly citizens in that way?
Because they ran the state. The state needs orderly citizens. This is the necessity for any state. You need people to obey the law and to obey authority.
But why do you need – okay, so why does the law become – and state authority become so important at that time? It seems to me that if you are a state but what you're ruling over are a bunch of subsistence farmers, then the need for law and order isn't as severe. You know, I mean, you just don't – it's not as paramount. Whereas if you are ruling over groups of people that are shoved all together – into the cities in order to work in factories, then the need for regulation and policing and discipline is much more obvious. And also, you know, you need to have someone who's self-regulating so that they will, on their own initiative, come to work each day, work a full day in a disciplined manner, and go home and rest instead of go out and get drunk or...
Yeah. Oh, I think that's all true. I think that's all true. I'm just saying it wasn't simply an attempt to create an industrial working class.
No, no. I'm not saying it was like someone sat down and said, we need to create an industrial working class, therefore we will do this. I'm saying the pressure from the economy is what shaped the thinking of the lawmakers.
No, because – well, not really, because this begins before the Civil War when there's hardly – you can't – I mean, this was sort of the very beginning of the what we call the Industrial Revolution. This is when there are just a handful of factories in the United States, when still it's something like 80 or 90% agrarian, the population. You know, it's they're dealing with, they're cracking down on the Mormons because of polygamy, right? Which is not a nuclear family. I mean, by the way, this is one of the great untold stories. The Mormons were severely repressed by the state in the mid 19th century. Really before we have what looks like an industrial capitalist society here. And not only that, they were racialized, very interestingly. There was a dominant theory, this was subscribed to by the Supreme Court in its ruling against the Mormons, was that they had become a separate race unlike white people, because white people don't do this. White people live in nuclear families. And it's really about chaos and disorder. That's what they're concerned about, generally speaking. Now, that, of course, work is involved in that. You know, they're concerned about work. They want people to be good workers, of course, but it's actually usually secondary. They're mostly concerned about things like soldiers, because this is during the period of the Civil War. This is during the period of national consolidation. This is when the United States really becomes a national entity, the United States, and they are very worried about people going off into their own little enclaves and having their own little cultures and not being identified with America as a nation. And so this is what they're saying. You can look at the Reynolds case. I was just looking at this. This is in 1878. This is the big decision by the Supreme Court, basically begging, right? So it's sort of upholding a law against polygamy in Utah. It's very interesting. It's really crucial. It's a turning point because it's between Reconstruction. By the way, we haven't talked about this. So the slaves, of course, one of the major problems with the slaves was that they also didn't have nuclear families for various reasons. Either you could say it was because they couldn't, because of the fact that they could be sold away. Or I like to say it's also because they simply preferred to live in extended families where the children were raised by everybody. Either way, they simply weren't in nuclear families for the most part on the plantations. And this was one of the major problems, it was said, about them. And this was said by abolitionists. This was said by their so-called friends. And this is what needed to be reformed. So one of the things in Reconstruction that was done explicitly was the slaves, the ex-slaves, were trained how to be good American citizens in various ways. And one of the ways was that they would be husband and wife instead of lovers or partners or occasional paramours. So that the Reynolds case comes right after Reconstruction. It's the same thing they're trying to do to the Mormons. They're trying to assimilate them into this culture. And then just 10 years after that, or 20 years after that, of course, the United States invades and conquers the Philippines and does, guess what? Exactly the same thing with the Philippines. When it colonizes the Philippines, sets up schools across the Philippines to make all those people, those brown savages, into us. And at the center of it, in all three of those projects, in Reconstruction, with the outlawing of polygamy in Utah and in the Philippines, it was to, first and foremost, they said this, we have to put these people into families, nuclear families. That's where discipline is inculcated. That's how we train people to regulate themselves. The parents must become self-regulating. They can't depend on anyone else, including the state, if they're in a nuclear family, because as I said, they have to do all this work to maintain this independent, onerous thing. So it's bourgeois. It's serving state interests, which are apart from, I think, capitalist economic interests. They often are intertwined, but not always. They're not always synonymous.
Well, it depends on what you think the source of the state's economic power is. I mean, if you're a state in a country where the capital is not very developed, you know, you're going to be very much constrained in what kind of power you have as a state. And if you're in a state where capital is developed quite far, then you're going to have a much better tax base and a much better material basis to, you know, make armies and things too. So,
right.
So, I mean, yeah, I mean, I don't think you can really separate out the economy from the state. I think the state is basically in service of the economy. That's my Marx.
Right. I think it's just the opposite. So no, you can't separate. I don't think you can separate them. I agree with that. But no. So if you look, certainly in this country, this simply, I just don't see the evidence for that claim. It's just the other way around. If you look at the founding fathers, pretty much to a man, they were imperialists from the get-go. You know, and when we think of imperialism, we think of conquering nations overseas. But no, as we all know, they were imperialist when they got here. Right. When the first settlers got here, they were imperialist. They talked about this as their mission. And it was really to make this comes from Locke and natural law and classical liberalism. It was to make this land that the Indians were wasting by not making it commercial, productive, to make it productive, to make it useful. So, yes, it was to make the land productive economically, but that was their sort of – it was the mission given to them by God. It was a godly mission. I think they actually believed in that. And so to do that though, that requires expansion. It requires movement. It requires conquest, which requires an army, which requires an economic base that can supply the army with military equipment so that you can – shoot the Indians instead of using spears against them so that you can win. Right. And so, but that goes all the way through, you know, Manifest Destiny, westward expansion, the Civil War, Reconstruction, Spanish American, all that stuff, all the way through. So it's, so yes, they're always saying we must have a powerful economy, but in order to expand as an empire, to create an empire, the empire was what was driving it. Not the other way around. They weren't, their objective was not to become wealthy, a wealthy economic power. It was to become a powerful state, a global state. And so to do that, they understood, required having a powerful, superior economy.
Right. Well, we should just clarify that, you know, I'm the Marxist here and you're the not Marxist. And when it comes to knowing the history, I mean, you're going to always win those debates. I'd have to go and Google to try to come up with my, you know, citations, but I just think that fundamentally, it's always very complicated, right? I mean, I don't think you're wrong in anything that you described, but my sort of interpretive framework says, yes, he's absolutely right. But imperialism itself arrives because capitalism is a tendency to concentrate and then need to expand in order to keep itself going, and so that the there are economic demands that are made, and the state is functioning to meet those demands, maybe not very well and maybe not ideologically, but that's when it succeeds, that's why. I've read Lenin's imperialism is the highest form of capitalism or something like that. Is the name of the essay. And I just feel like our major difference here is just in how we conceive of capitalism more than actually whether or not we agree about. I mean, I'm going to just say every historical reference you make is absolutely correct because I don't have it all in front of me and I don't have a degree in it. But I think that we might have some disagreements about what capitalism is.
Yeah. And so this is great because we were also going to talk about Foucault, right? And this is actually a way to circle back or to come back or to introduce Foucault here. And we'll eventually get back to the young men who listen to podcasts too. But that's fine. Right. I think this is it. This comes down to it. So what do you think causes people to invest in capital, to become capitalists, to employ workers, to build businesses and build industries? What is it, right? This is one of the big unanswered questions.
You mean originally or today?
Ever. You name it. You tell me.
Today?
You can identify a capitalist, you can identify a group of capitalists, and then
I'll give you an anecdotal example, okay?
Yeah.
So I knew someone who started her own chocolate company.
Mm-hmm.
And she was working with me at the Oregon Symphony at the time. We were both working the ticket office and the subscription department, meaning we were making phone calls to get people to subscribe to the symphony. She had a college degree, but she didn't have, for whatever reasons, she wasn't going to be hired on anywhere to be, you know, in management. So she thought to herself, well, I have connections. I can scrape together some capital to invest to start with. I can get a sweetheart loan or an angel investor, probably in the form of her dad, to help me start this business. And I bet I can make this go because I make really good chocolate. And she did. Her chocolate was good. It was, you know, not the best candy bar I'd ever had, but it was better than Hershey's. And she had an interesting idea. But she did all that because she was unhappy as a worker in that environment. She had better prospects, at least more ambition than that, to because of the way she grew up. And she had the ability to get out of there and be in a better position. So that's why she started her own chocolate company. It didn't succeed ultimately, or it's out of business now, but who knows what investments and entrepreneurial and, you know, endeavors she's going through.
Well, that doesn't really answer the question though. Okay. In other words, what did she want, or what did she think she wanted, or what did she, you know, you can also have unconscious desires. In other words, what was at the base? What was driving her in that particular direction?
She wanted to be somebody. She didn't want to be a mom. She wanted to be the CEO of her own company. She, you know, put her picture of herself on her brochures, and she wanted to establish herself in the world as someone of significance. And different ways to do that. You know, you can do that by making a podcast. You can do that by getting a really plush job in a nice office. You can do that by starting your own company. And that was the other reason.
Yeah. That sounds right to me. Of course, I don't know her, but I've known a lot of capitalists, and I've read about a lot of capitalists. And so what you're describing is social capital is what she was interested in, right?
Well, yeah, two things though. It wasn't just social capital. It was one, not having to go to work and get measly money and worry about whether she can afford her next drink or her next meal at a, you know, not that she was starving, but like her next meal at a restaurant kind of thing, you know, not have to worry about picking up the bill. And then the other, thing was to be somebody, to get respect. Those are the two things, but they're not the same. And I think both are big factors. I mean, if she thought I can do this and people will respect me, but I'll still be poor, she wouldn't have done it.
Right. So the psychological rewards that come from high status.
Yeah.
Yep. Right. Okay. Well, so that is basically Max Weber's theory about capitalists. That, you know, because he was writing in the turn of the 20th century, and the so-called robber barons were, you know, a thing, and they were sort of celebrities, Rockefeller, Carnegie, these guys. And he noticed that they had more money than God, but they kept working. They wouldn't stop working. Not only that, Rockefeller made his children wear hand-me-down clothes. It's amazing. Carnegie and Rockefeller basically gave away all of their fortune. Right. That's why we have all of these libraries and museums all over the country. They were ascetic. They were puritanical. And not only that, they talked about it. They said that this is what rich people should do. They should make money so that they could give it away, which is what the original Puritans said, by the way, about wealth. Puritans were not against accumulation of wealth. They simply said it should be accumulated but not spent on oneself. It should be used in service of God's community. Right. So what Max Weber concluded, you know, not that he could prove this, but I think it's a pretty good theory, is that they were driven by this desire to be paternal figures to the world, basically fathers to the world, sort of having not quite what your friend wanted, but like high status, to be respected, to have authority, really power. They were interested in power over anything else. And now you can get power in any way, right? Or not in any way, but there are many ways you can get it. And making a lot of money is simply one of them. So that is the American puritanical take on capitalism. I would say that's what drives it. And that's a different thing than just profit motive. Most Americans think, non-Marxist Americans think, right, that, oh, capitalists just want to get rich so that they can party and, you know, sit in a jacuzzi with six bikini models and drinking champagne all day long.
There's only one that I know of that's like that, and that would be Trump.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. So he is he's the first working class capitalist, basically.
Right. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And so this is crucial, though. And so in other words, what I'm arguing here is that the culture drives capitalism. Or a psychology, even. It's even deeper than that. But it's not really what we often think of as driving capitalism. So in other words, this answers the question I was raising, or I was really offering an answer to the question, which is that why is there imperialism, right? Uh-huh. Why did these people go to war? Why did these presidents go to war? First of all, they didn't benefit materially ever.
No.
There's no president who benefited materially from war. In fact, if anything, they lost money usually. Dick Cheney, vice president, but still, he a good example. You know, he divested from Halliburton before the war started. He didn't gain any money from that.
No.
There was no.
Yeah, I'm not ever saying that there people do it out of personal greed. I mean, I think sometimes people do that kind of thing, but those kind of capitalists don't tend to last. I mean, I totally agree with you that. When you are talking about the motivations of capitalists, they're not motivated by some, you know, direct greed or, you know, they're not gluttons. They're usually highly disciplined. But all I would point out is that capitalism as a system is one in which, the world is alienated from the human. So, in other words, even the capitalists are working in service of an abstraction. They're not working in service for themselves, even when they're living very nice lives. That's a secondary effect. The main thing is they're working on producing value, is what Marx would call it. They're producing profit. They're producing the ability to expand. You want to make enough so you can reinvest, so you can make your business even bigger and more successful. Otherwise, it will start to fail. And so that's all true. I just want to say, like, it may be that this theory that, you know, the puritanical drive and was a big factor in shaping how capitalism came to be, but it then became materialized in our practices. And it is now a productive force in the world. It's not merely an ideological force. If we changed our minds and changed our values, if all the capitalists changed their minds and changed their values, that would be a short-lived experiment unless we also change the way we operate productively.
Right. And what I'm saying is that the state is not in service of capitalists or capitalism. Mm-hmm. The proof of that really is, again, sorry to do this, but, you know, you look at history.
That's fine. So, history is important. And I know that this is like, I'm not bragging that I don't know the history as well as I should. So, well, I'm always glad to hear it.
It's funny. It puts me in a weird position because, you know, obviously it's my specialization. So I've spent a lot of time studying it, but it's on some level unfair. Actually, it is, because it's rare that I'll be talking to someone who has as much knowledge of American history as I do. And so I trot out these facts, and basically I'm putting you in the position of just taking my word for it. Then again, you know, as soon as you turn off this podcast, you can quite easily go search these things yourself and find them out. But anyway, but I think when I try to present these facts from American history, or history generally, I try to present them in a way that sort of shows that they sort of make sense in terms of my argument in themselves, that you know enough about this stuff that it actually sort of comes together. So we can just think about capitalism and war, right? So as I said, of course, global empire especially requires a lot of war, and that's what it's done over the last 200 plus years. There's just been a lot of war, a lot of invasions, a lot of conquest, a lot of colonization, a lot of occupations, all that stuff, lots of war. Now, is that always going to be, to what extent is that in the service of capitalism? Is that consistent with capitalism? With the interests of capitalists? And it turns out, well, you can just think about this for a second, right? What happens in a war, right? So certain capitalists obviously benefit, you know, the arms manufacturers, no doubt about it. They love war and always have, there's no question. Then there are some, in some cases, there are certain capitalist interests that have a production going on in another territory, another country that the United States is interested in invading and maybe, you know, protecting from some nationalist or communist movement that wants to nationalize those productive facilities. Sure, in those cases, uniformly, you know, United Fruit and all their friends, you know, they absolutely wanted the state to intervene. So their interests coincided with the state's interests in that moment. Now, those are the exceptions, though. The vast majority of capitalists, and including this is big capitalists, the vast majority have opposed wars, American wars and European wars. Because why? Because trade is seriously disrupted. You can't ship things across the ocean when there's battleships firing at each other in the Atlantic or the Pacific. Trade is disrupted everywhere. The working class has to be shunted off to some other land to go fight and die. You're losing lots of your workers. You have to replace them with inferior workers. It creates a labor shortage, which means a tight labor market, which means the labor force, the working class, has much more power, which leads to strikes, which we see in all during all the wars, you know, massive strikes in all the industries, tremendous working class power. Capitalists don't like that. They have to pay higher wages. So it's not in the interest of capitalists. Now, you could argue that long term, sure, maybe that the conquest of a place that has natural resources that capitalists will then use, sure, would benefit the economy as a whole. But that's always far ranging. And as we all know, Marxists or not, capitalists tend not to be future oriented in that way, right? And so it's not, yeah. So it's really hard to argue, actually, that imperialism and war is ever in the interest of capitalism or capitalists as a class.
Well, it depends on what you mean by, you know, in the interest of. The neat thing about the way Marx describes capitalism is that the capitalist class interest is actually split up. I mean, they're not individually, they're in competition with each other. They're not all on the same page. They don't have immediate interests in common always. The only way that the class interest overall emerges is in so much as things need to be organized together in order for the whole system to keep functioning, they have class interests there. But they're not as a class unified. Certainly not on the level of individuals.
I thought Marxists argued that they were unified on core principles and a core ideology.
No, that's the thing. I just read Lukács's Class Consciousness and did a podcast. The capitalists are primarily unable to, I mean, in Lukács's description, unable to develop a class consciousness that is unified, that they are unable to come, because you have to go to Hegel to understand why this makes any sense or why it's important. The idea is that as we progress through history, we're going to become better and better at getting our ideas into the world, that our intentions and reality are going to come closer together. And we'll get a better understanding of the way the world works. Now, this all gets complicated because for Hegel, the world works through negation. So the world works through a split. The world works in so much as it's never actually complete. It's always, you know, the one becomes two, to put it in Maoist terms. But the important thing is that the bourgeois class weren't able to realize their intent ideologically because the material basis for their project relied upon developing a class in opposition to them, the proletariat. They couldn't move beyond that contradiction. And you have to look deep into Marxology here to see all the different ways in which the capitalists live with contradiction. One of the big ones is that there's always this tendency for the rate of profit to decline when things are going well, when you're producing at the fastest speed, when you're employing people en masse and you're producing huge numbers of commodities. That's when you're going to start to see a decline in profits, according to Marx. So, you know, yeah, the bourgeois class is an ideological class as individuals. There's a kind of an aggregate, aim for the whole class, but they aren't able to fully realize their total intent and practice because they rely upon this contradiction, which they can't overcome.
Well, okay. But then Lukács is unlike most Marxist thinkers, right? I mean, most Marxist thinkers, including Marx himself and Engels, right, have argued pretty consistently that there is such a thing as a capitalist ideology and a capitalist culture, and that it achieved hegemony.
I don't know. Where did Marx write about a capitalist culture? I mean, maybe you know Marx better than I do, but I don't remember him writing about a capitalist culture. What I remember him writing about is the way capital functions. And he starts like with talking about Adam Smith. He's not talking about, religious practices or the ideas of the capitalists. Those things aren't important to Marx. So what's important is like the commodity, the commodity form, exchange value. All those things are what he starts talking about.
Well, so, right. So he, you know, his whole project begins with a flipping of Hegel, right? So for Hegel, the zeitgeist is sort of this independent spirit that's above and independent of the material world. And Marx says it's exactly the other way around. The zeitgeist, the dominant ideas of the time, I think that might even be a phrase from him, come from the material base of society. And in a capitalist society, the dominant ideas of the time reflect and support and perpetuate the capitalist mode of production. No?
That's true. Yeah.
Oh, but okay,
that's true. The dominant ideas, but the dominant ideas are, you know, a form of false consciousness. They're not consistent. They're not always coherent. They're not put into practice the way that the capitalists believe that they are necessarily, you know, you're not looking at a class that has really taken hold of the reins of history, to put it in Hegel-ese, or, you know, you're looking at a class that is managing a process which is quite gotten away from out of human control. Now it's, rather than being a world dominated by people, we're people dominated by commodities.
This just sounds unlike most Marxists that I've read. Coming back to this connects to the family discussion, right? So this was Engels' theory about the family, as you well know. You mentioned it, right?
Marx don't always agree, but yes, Engels does have a theory about the family.
I'm saying he's saying that serves the interest of capitalism. The dominant idea about the nuclear family, Engels said, right, serves the interest of capitalism.
Serves the interest of capital. Yeah, of capitalism. Sure.
Capital.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it doesn't necessarily serve the interest of the consciousness of a group of capitalist people. It serves the aims of a system.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like – it's like saying like I'm sitting at the Sorry board. I'm playing Sorry. And what I'd really like is a game that's cooperative and that's my whole aim is to say I'm bourgeois. So my whole aim is to liberate every individual at the Sorry board. But the rules of the game work so that someone's going to lose and, you know, unfairly say. So, I can keep playing this game and if I'm bourgeois, I will, but I'm never going to get what I want out of that process.
Hmm. Okay. I want to attack you on this false consciousness stuff, but we'll table that for a second.
Okay.
But again, that'll get us back to Foucault. Because that's kind of a thing that
Let's just jump to Foucault. Can I just say, like, this is my problem with Foucault is that
go ahead.
That he thinks of power in terms of something that's immediate, positive, and that isn't when he talks about control, he doesn't see how the mechanisms of control are operating against material practices, which have their own logic. Mm-hmm. And he, so to me, he believes too fully in the ability of human beings to put their practices in, you know, into direct, immediate expression. He's like, you know, he's the anti-humanist and I'm the humanist, but I'm the one who says, no, we're split off from the world. We kind of do things and then these things have effects on us over time that we can't quite track, especially as things scale up.
Oh, I just remembered why we're doing this podcast is that you posted something on Facebook about humanism and I said something, what did I say? Something like, you said that Marxism is a humanist project. And I said, yeah, that's why I'm not a Marxist.
Right. Right. That's why we're having this conversation.
That's right. And then you said, oh, we'll come on the podcast to discuss it. And I said, hell yeah. All right. So, yes, Foucault is a great anti-humanist, as am I. And you're right. Marx was a humanist. Marxism is humanism for sure. Yeah, it's a terrible idea. One of the worst ever. maybe the worst ever. It might actually be at the root of all the worst things that have happened in modern history, in fact. It's the idea, am I right, that all human beings share things in common. They share, you can sort of, you know, different humanists identify different things that we share in common, but that is the presumption or assumption of humanism, isn't it?
Yeah, my way of thinking about it and is I'm sort of a weird Cartesian humanist. So that I think that what we all share in common is the cogito, the fact of our reasoning and our self-aware experience.
Yeah, it's funny. Yeah, it's funny. It's funny that I like you and we're friends because those are the worst ideas to me joining them together is just the perfect totalitarian storm. It's just like
worst. I'll tell you why I can be friends with people who completely diametrically oppose me more easily than I can sometimes with people who are supposed to be on my side. Just because when I find someone who really diametrically is in opposition to what I'm saying, they'll tell me directly. They're not going to, you know, play any games. It's like, you know, let's hash this out. We disagree. And on terms that we both understand, we're not going to, you know, hedge it. This is good. I think it's good that we should. Well, this is a fruitful friendship, I think.
Well, I'll tell you why I'm friends with you. It's not that. It's that your personality is – there's nothing about it that I've seen that's totalitarian or even authoritarian at all. In fact, you have one of the least authoritarian personalities of anyone I've ever known, which is very interesting because I think – well, your politics are more complicated, first of all, than just this sort of humanism meets logic, cogito, you know. That is fascism. But anyway, it's global fascism. It's worse. It's actually worse than 20th century fascism because it has global ambitions for all of us. So anyway, I
want to defend Descartes in a second, but go on. Tell me nice things about myself. I'll take it.
Yeah, no, it's true. let's see. Yeah. So anyway, you should sound like Sam Harris, but you don't. Like that's your politics or Sam Harris's politics, basically. I think at the bottom, that's what they are. I'm sorry to tell you.
I don't know. See, maybe I don't know Sam Harris well enough to debate that. I mean, I know he's sort of this, you know, he likes to present himself as the ultra rational and scientific. And I don't have, you know, I'm a science fiction writer. I'm not a neuroscientist, so I'm not going to claim that mantle. I know I'm always trying to learn. So, that's maybe the difference between me and Sam Harris. But as far as like I don't have, okay, like let me tell you about a different Cartesian guy who is different than I am. And it's, Noam Chomsky also believes in Cartesian common sense and the cogito.
Mm-hmm. Sure does.
Very much believes that the only serious kinds of thought are scientific.
In right.
other words, if you're not being rigorously scientific, yep. you're not really getting at anything substantial.
Yep.
But what's interesting about him is that his politics are not scientific. It's like Chomsky's. Yeah. He, and explicitly so. He completely believes that his work as a linguist and his work as a political activist don't touch each other. And that because he works on the levels of moral truisms, and in a realm that no one has any real understanding of when he works in politics.
Okay.
And so, yeah, but so like, I'm not like that. I don't think that we can limit reason to just the realm of the scientific. I don't think that's the only way we can think in a reasonable way. And, I like old philosophical questions like, you know, what is real? Or what's the meaning of life even, which to Chomsky are just sort of not real questions, you know? So
I think the reason I like you is that you are a terrible scientific humanist. I think you don't live up to your stated politics at all. Or, well, I don't know about it all, but you very poorly. You do a really bad job of it. So, and that's what, seriously, I mean it.
Yeah. Okay.
So I think Harris and Chomsky do generally, I know what you mean about Chomsky. So first of all, one of Chomsky's, I was going to say critiques, but it's really hatreds because he really hates this stuff. One of his big hatreds of Foucault and postmodernism is that it rejects moral absolutes. This is what Chomsky says. We need moral absolutes, you know, universal absolute ideas about good and bad. And that's the whole problem with these French fuckers, is that they just do away with this thing that must guide our politics. Now, morality is not scientific, right? I mean, Nietzsche was the first to call this out. There's nothing scientific at all or rational at all about morality. It's simply a claim. It's an assertion. It's no different than saying there is a God. It's an assertion that cannot be verified. It can't be analyzed using the scientific method. You can't prove or disprove it. No evidence can be brought to bear to show that it's right or wrong. Correct?
Yeah.
That's what morality is, definitionally.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Look, just get to the end, because I'm not sure I totally agree with you, but I want to open up another realm for reason beyond just this positivist, if it's not falsifiable, it's not real approach to reason. But go ahead.
Sam Harris says that, oh, no, morality, there is an objective ethics, as a matter of fact. You can prove what is good and bad.
Right.
He literally says this. I mean, this is what by using the scientific method. And how does he do this? Well, he says, well, there's such a thing called well-being. Well-being, the well-being of human beings. So the maximization of well-being is what is morally good.
Yeah.
Well, so that's just obvious if you're Sam Harris and if you have no clue that there is any way of thinking outside of modern Western thought, right? There's no way of viewing the world outside of the way that Western Europeans and Americans do in the 21st century. Because, well, we just know what well-being is here, don't we? We do have a not universal, but pretty close to a consensus view as Americans these days of what well-being is. I mean, or at least I'd say it's a majority, right? It's a culture. We have there's this dominant idea about what well-being is. It constitutes various things. Well, guess what, Sam? Guess what, Noam? Guess what, Doug? You know this. They don't. This is another reason why I like you. There have been and continue to be not multiple, but infinite ways of defining well-being. And all he's doing is simply asserting that our definition is the correct one of well-being. It's pure imperialism, is it not?
Well, I don't know if it's imperial or not, but probably. But here's the thing that I think about Sam Harris as far as all that goes. He's a utilitarian ethicist, right? Mm-hmm. I mean,
Yeah, maybe. Keep going. Yeah.
A utilitarian ethicist is someone who says the way to determine whether or not something is good or bad is to decide whether or not it brings happiness or pleasure or some sort of positive feeling into the world, right? And you can calculate that. This is like Jeremy Bentham, okay?
Well, okay, keep going. Yeah,
all right.
Keep going.
So that's his – when he talks about well-being, he's talking about a kind of utilitarian ethics – where, you know, maximizing happiness or maximizing pleasure, whether it's a higher form of pleasure or a lower form of pleasure, usually people talk about a higher form of pleasure. That's his aim, right? But the problem with utilitarian ethics is that when you try to apply it, it's not even whether or not you're defining pleasure the same way. It's when you try to like apply it, there are all these exceptions. Like, you know, for instance, the classic one is, okay, what's going to maximize, well-being? Let's just leave well-being or health. Let's call it health. What's going to maximize health at a hospital? Mm-hmm. Well, patient goes in and has a cold, and there are five people. One needs a liver, one needs a heart, one needs some lungs. So, you know, two more need other organs. So you do to maximize health, you kill the guy with the sniffles and give his organs to these other people. That way more people are experiencing pleasure and a good and well-being than would be the case if you didn't kill him and, you know, harvest his organs. So you're left with, at least intuitively, very immoral action, that's justified by your morality. So, and, you know, the same kinds of things apply for rule-based Kantian ethics, where, you know, you just say never treat anyone like as a means, but always as an end, or never be dishonest. You have these rules of how to behave, but then there are all these, you can concoct thought experiment exception, and there are real exceptions in the world. So my problem with moral theory at the moment is that I haven't landed on one that is consistent and in a way that I can fully embrace. So I just try my best. And that's, by the way, what Chomsky does. That's not, Chomsky is not a utilitarian. He probably is some sort of Kantian, but he doesn't cop to it. What he says is, when it comes to politics and morality, we don't have a full understanding of the structures in our biology that give us our sense of morality. All we have are common sense understandings, which he then thinks are universalized. Yeah. But he doesn't have a calculus of morality the way that exactly. Sam Harris does.
Yeah. Okay. So you use the word pleasure, which is really important here. I don't know. Does Bentham actually use that term?
I don't know. Let me look.
I doubt it. If he talks about maximization of pleasure as a good, I'd be surprised, because I know that Chomsky and Sam Harris and these rational humanists we've been talking about, who, of course, what we're really talking about is the Enlightenment project. These guys are kind of like
– he talks about happiness. Jeremy these are the, talks yeah, about happiness.
Yes, that's right. That's right. So pleasure is a problem for Enlightenment thinkers, for the Enlightenment project. As a matter of fact, I argue – and this is kind of through all of my work, if you look at my book, Renegade History of the United States, in one way this is really the theme of it. It is – the Enlightenment, of course, is the replacement of God and religious thinking with science and rationality. That's really what it is in a sentence. And that's what these guys are upholding. They're kind of the apotheosis of the Enlightenment, right? Mm-hmm. Who we're talking about here? Rational humanists. Mm-hmm. This, right. These are paragons, I should say, of the Enlightenment. Have you ever looked at the video in which Chomsky is interviewed in his office at MIT when he's eating a tuna fish sandwich about, and that's actually important. I included that because it's actually important. The fact that he was in his office and that he's eating a tuna fish sandwich while he's doing an interview about pornography and popular culture.
No, I haven't seen that one.
Everyone should go look at that immediately. You just Google it, and I think it comes up right away on YouTube. You'll see there's a video lecture interview with him in which he talks about those subjects. Guess what Noam Chomsky thinks about pornography in particular and popular culture, American popular culture now generally. What do you think?
Okay. I can tell you. He thinks that pornography is abusive to women, mm-hmm. that it's clearly debases the participants, and you just have to mm-hmm. look at it to realize that.
Yep.
And that popular culture, he's not particularly interested in popular culture. He has more bourgeois tastes. He likes classical music, opera, mm-hmm. that kind of thing.
Yeah. It's not just that. Yes. So you're right about the pornography. He says it's simply degrading toward women. That's it. That's all the pornography is. So guess what is not involved in pornography, according to Noam Chomsky? Pleasure. There's no pleasure in this, right?
So not even participants.
It doesn't even occur to him that there might be pleasure. It's simply an act of oppression. Right. This is what people like Andrew Dworkin and Catherine MacKinnon basically say, right? Pornography, there's no pleasure. It's just, they don't even say it's sadism. It's just oppression. It's just oppression of women. There's an oppressor and a victim. The oppressor is the viewer or the producer of pornography, and the victim is the woman who's in the pornography, right? So that's interesting. There's no pleasure there. In other words, he doesn't have an antenna for pleasure. It doesn't figure in, as you said, he has no calculus for it. It doesn't fit into his, he doesn't see it. He's not in that. It's not part of his world. Pop culture, it's not that he's uninterested in it. He says flat out that it's bad and inferior pop culture, what he sees. There are better things for people to do with their time. Better things for working class people to do with their time. It's just, it's poor. It's bad stuff. Because it mostly traffics in pleasure, immediate gratification, sex, alcohol, dancing, partying, all that stuff. That's what's true. If you look at billboards, if you watch TV, if you, you know, look at the internet and YouTube, that's what it is. Or stupid cat videos, which is just pleasure, right? You're just laughing at a cat doing something dumb. There's nothing intellectual. There's nothing what he would call political about it. It's not. And here's the thing. Here's the thing. None of it is rational. And he's right. There's nothing rational about sex. There's nothing rational about that kind of pleasure, right? The pleasures of the flesh, of the body, are not rational.
Well, this,
they're not.
I don't know.
You can't add them up. You can't do long division with them. There's no calculus for them. You can't quantify it. You can't say there's X amount of pleasure versus Y amount of something else. I mean, there's no way to measure it. There's no way to apply the scientific method to it.
Okay, according to Jeremy Bentham, you could measure pleasure. That's the whole idea of Jeremy Bentham. And he does talk about pleasure specifically. You know, pain and pleasure are the two masters of humanity, according to Bentham. So you can measure pleasure. I mean, there are all sorts of instruments you could do that with. There's also theories that develop. One of the big things among utilitarian ethicists would be to distinguish between lower forms of pleasure and higher forms of pleasure. Usually the difference is a matter of moderation and refinement. So a higher form of pleasure would be one which sustains you over the long term and doesn't have such terrible consequences. So like getting ripped is a pleasure, but it's not a high form of pleasure because the downsides are so severe, and it shortens in terms of health, your ability to maximize your pleasure. So the utilitarians are maximizers of pleasure through various methods.
I remain unconvinced that that's what they're about. So the mind-body split, the mind-body duality, right, which has been central in Western culture since the Greeks, since Plato, right, that really got sharpened and became dominant in Western discourse with the Enlightenment. And so when they replaced God with science, that was really the big move to establish the dominance of the mind and rationality and reason over the body and sensual pleasure and animalistic desires. That's what's in the body in the way that Westerners think. And so that's who these guys, that's what they're about. And it's no surprise to me that they tend to come out of science backgrounds. They tend to come out of science classes or science degree programs, or this is who they are, right? Sam Harris was a neuroscientist. Chomsky's linguistics, but he does it in the sort of science way. It's like he has these ideas that if you just look at the brain, you know, using microscopes, et cetera, you know, by measuring things, by analyzing things using numbers and quantitative measures, you can sort of figure out how we're wired. There's a wiring, hard wiring. It's scientific. So what I'm talking about is scientism, not science. The belief that science and rationality, reason and logic are a direct portal to reality and truth. So for Sam Harris, it's how we get to moral truth. For Chomsky, it's how we get to moral truth, political truth, all truth. And that's the problem. That's the problem.
So let me first just, of all, can I jump in and say something to that? Okay,
sure.
So I agree with you that I'm like totally against scientism and the notion that science is a direct portal to truth is not scientific. I mean, that's ridiculous. And Chomsky would agree with me on that, by the way, because Chomsky would say, look, we are biological beings with certain faculties and that what they are most of all is filters. I mean, they construct a world for us that we don't have. There's no way to even conceive of. It's not even feasible to conceive of a direct access to reality. Instead, we have, you know, apparatuses which then help us to understand and what we can as the kinds of beings that we are. And that, so for him, there's no direct access to the world through science. That's ridiculous. What there is there's slow, incremental understandings that develop rigorously through a scientific process that then are immediate, you know, always subject to revision. And that's truth as we can have it, given the kinds of beings that we are. That's Chomsky's view. And it's not that I don't think is controversial. I mean, and I'm very skeptical, incredibly skeptical of this idea that there we have access through some direct romantic physical biological experience of truth, that if unless what we're that isn't just a tautology, it's like I'm having this experience. But I mean, because I have had too many experiences where, for instance, I've gotten angry and then really thought about it later and thought, you know what, you were a dick and you were in the wrong, and your experience of the moral situation was wrong and you had to think it through to come to the understanding that you shouldn't have yelled at the librarian, you know, for a specific example. I think that the notion of direct apprehension, the notion that we're not always engaged in a process of interpretation, that's what is really scary. Whether it's some authoritarian Sam Harris type who just thinks he's got such a firm grip on the answer that he can just assert without any pushback his position and then people should accept it or shut up, which is really his position. Or, this idea that, well, no, look, I had an experience and you can't understand it because it was my experience and it's true because of my experience. Both those things are wrong.
Okay. So to be fair to Sam Harris, something I don't like to be, but I think he agrees with Chomsky's position on this. And it sounds like yours as well, which is that no, there's no direct, it's not a direct portal but that reason and rationality and the scientific method move us closer, right, to truth or reality. Is that right?
Yeah.
That's what you say. Yeah.
I mean,
and you said
we accrue these understandings, and I'm not even sure, like, from Chomsky's perspective, I don't think that I think he's truly a Kantian. Like, the reality, the truth, is forever cut off. We will never have access to it. That's his position.
But he believes there is an objective external truth or reality that is independent of human consciousness, correct?
And we don't have access to it at all.
As do Sam Harris, as do all the utilitarians and Bentham and all these people we're talking about, right?
Well, I'm more Hegelian. Like, I think that there's that the weird thing is that reality itself is incomplete. I'm really just projecting on this. I think that reality itself is incomplete. That what we, if we're going to talk in a way that makes any sense about reality, what we're talking about is a lived experience. That is always what reality is. If the world and the fact that we experience something that's outside of us is actually a part of our experience as well.
And so, but you believe, don't you, that the use of rationality moves us toward reality or truth?
Yeah, this is a good question. I'm not sure if I would say moving us towards it. I would say we develop our understanding through rationality and truth, and that we then also can shape what's how the world works. You know, not maybe on the level of, well, I mean, some, maybe on the level of subatomic, you know, I don't know, but I certainly social, certainly in the, in terms of, how we work together to survive and what we're able to do and what our reality is. Like we could go to Mars. That would be a very different kind of reality, but I don't know if that, means that we're closer to something that's out there beyond us that's permanent and fixed. I think that reality itself, is incomplete. Not that it's, you know, nothing, but that it's incomplete.
Okay. Well, you did earlier say, I think that, you know, you said that at least people think that, rationality moves us closer. And then you said, I don't think that's a controversial claim. Well, as a matter of fact, it's totally controversial.
Yeah, you're right.
And that's Foucault's entire project.
At this
really.
Point, I'm going to hit rewind and we'll go back and like, I'll replay me saying that.
yeah.
Right. Okay.
But that's, I think you know this, right? That's Foucault's whole project, right? That's the whole thing. He has said that pretty much all of my work, I think he has said, that is an attempt to call into question this belief in the necessity of things. That's the word that's used, at least in the translation. The necessity of human experience and human behaviors, right? So he's calling into question essentialism, that there's sort of a biological or physical fact reality that determines human beings in any way. Mm-hmm. So, and he says that this belief in a reality or a truth that is outside of human consciousness, it is independent of us, is the basis for the exertion of power and the worst forms of power in modern history. So, if you believe that all people share things in common, all people on Earth, which is hell of a claim, first of all, right? Since you haven't met everybody, you don't even know who these people are. You sort of have a number, maybe, that there is X number of people in the world. You're making a claim for people who aren't born yet. You're making claims for people who have been dead for millennia. You're making claims for people who live in Bangladesh, who you know zero about, except that they might exist, according to World Bank statistics or something. It's a hell of a claim, and I don't see how it's anything but theological, first of all. Then, on top of that, you're saying that what unites them is this ability to reason or rationality. At least there's something innate in human beings that separates them from animals that is this thing, which is fine. But it's more that there's a valorization of that, of rationality. There's a you place rationality, the mind, the reason above other things like the body, like sensual pleasure, like sex, like porn, like eating a sandwich that's not tuna fish sandwich, like eating.
What's wrong with tuna fish sandwich? Well, you said that was important before, and I just have to ask, like, what the hell is your deal with tuna fish? I mean, it's fine.
Because it's totally ordinary. It's plain. I eat tuna fish too, but I eat it when I'm in a hurry.
Yeah.
Like when I'm in a hurry, usually to go to work, and that's what Chomsky was signaling. I'm in a hurry to work, so I'm going to do this interview while I'm eating my lunch because I don't want to waste any time just eating. I would never waste time just eating lunch and just enjoying the food. It's just a means to an end. It's just fuel so that I can do more work. I'm in my office also, by the way, when I'm eating my lunch. I thought it was important. Anyway.
Okay. I got you now.
So
I just wondered what that signified to you. No,
so then
I love everything you're saying. I think I have some answers to it, but like,
wait, I'm not finished.
Go. Keep going.
Yeah. I'm pulling together the ultimate, condemnation of you and your thoughts.
Well,
so let me finish.
I just have to say, and maybe this is now we won't be friends after I say this. I don't feel too threatened, but go on.
No, I know. Yeah. okay. And then so if rationality is good, right? That morally good, and it can bring us to truth or reality, then what we need to do is apply rationality and all that means to the organization of human beings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, yeah. I can see why this is okay. All very scary. I mean, I can see brown shirts marching back and forth in the background.
Yeah, well, okay. And so then the question is, okay, then what is rationality, guys? And it turns out that when that term has been, or that concept has been employed or deployed is really the word, in the modern era in Europe and America, it has meant scientific method, scientific management, engineering. It has meant reducing people to numbers, to bodies, making people and the apparatuses in a society into machines, making the world into a well-ordered society. These are phrases that might be, you might be remembering things, this might be bringing things to mind. So this is progressivism, right? This is what progressivism was. I mean, this is what they themselves said, you know, and that's why we have city managers in this country now to this day. That's a progressive move, was to put, and these are actually engineers, people from, you know, the sciences, you know, who manage these cities. That was a great progressive measure. And so we also know we can figure out what is good and bad in the world by, you know, applying scientific method. Now, so that's why we can just prove that Islam is inherently violent and produces jihad and 9/11. Because, well, you just look at the damn text and you can see, obviously, this is what it says. Read the text, and you read the text all together and you see it says, "Thou shalt take vengeance against the infidels." Well, that obviously just means 9/11. And because, now that's Sam Harris, what I'm doing there, right? And that's his whole thing. And he has this amazing like video in which he does this. And it's sort of like, well, one of the things, one of the beliefs or assumptions in this rationality thing is that texts are transparent and that there is a single meaning, single true meaning in texts. And you just, otherwise, right? Science doesn't work. It's irrelevant. Like, how do you determine what a text says? How can you prove with a scientific method, with rationality, what a text means? It's an incredible thought, right? How can you?
I have an answer to one way. I think the best way to read a book if you're wanting to discover the truth of it, in other words, when you're wanting to figure out what it most likely means, and that is to give it a charitable reading, where what you're trying to do is steel man the arguments in it and make it as